Hi there. I'm Melissa Bowman for CKMS News on 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode, where we will hear from Fariel Diwan and William Turman, who have been involved with a recent report highlighting issues around displacement locally. The Mapping Displacement Project was conducted in collaboration with the Social Development Center of Waterloo Region and the University of Waterloo. The project explored lived experiences of displacement due to gentrification and development in the core areas of Kitchener and Waterloo. The report states that there is no shortage of data around new development and investments in the downtown core. However, there is a dearth of data related to what may be lost through those changes and growth. This report is an attempt to collect and highlight those experiences not currently captured in the data through amplifying the knowledge and lived experiences of those living through gentrification and displacement so that their voices can play a more central role in housing planning and policy. In order to collect these stories, researchers sought input from individuals from underserved communities who were precariously housed, forced to move out from affordable homes, and pushed outside the region's urban core. Participants included Black, Indigenous, and people of color, seniors, and persons with disabilities. The report says that participants shared stories of discrimination, rising rents, exploitative landlords, illegal evictions, a lack of affordable housing options, and insufficient enforcement of rules meant to protect tenants needs to be interpreted as patterns, not isolated incidents. And since we will be hearing a lot about displacement and gentrification, we should clarify those terms. The report states that gentrification and displacement mean the people who once made urban space their home are no longer able to live their everyday lives and experience a profound loss of control over their lives. Let's hear more about the report from two people involved in the creation of it, Fariel Diwan and William Turman.
My name is William Turman. I just recently graduated from the master's program in planning at the University of Waterloo, and that's my connection with the project. I was a research assistant with Brian Doucette, who is part of the project. Through Brian Doucette, I connected with the SDC and was helping with this project. And since then, I've also been volunteering with the Unsheltered Campaign and various other housing advocacy groups in Kitchener-Waterloo. So I've always kind of I've been interested in housing in Waterloo region for a while too. So,
excellent. And Fariel?
Yeah. So I'm the social planning associate at Social Development Center. I started volunteering with Social Development Center in about 2018. I started working on this project in 2019 when I was working there as a summer staff. And I mean, I guess I ended up in Waterloo because I was doing my undergrad at University of Waterloo in geography and environmental management. And I've always been interested in looking at people and how they interact with urban spaces. And growing up in Karachi, you'll actually see a lot of similar things that are happening even now in this city versus Kitchener.
What motivated the Social Development Center to do this work specifically? And what did you think was maybe missing from the existing narrative that motivated this work to be done?
So Social Development Center has been working on their oral history project for some time now, when they were working on that before I had started this mapping project, and you know, also supporting tenants, for example, at Trainer Vanier well before that. So there's always been an interest to support tenants and individuals and groups with lived experience. And this project was important to highlight larger issues of various forms of displacement through lived experience. And for me, like, this project or map is by no means complete, and there's room to do so much more. And I mean, I would like to delve deeper into the experiences of displacement from, you know, Indigenous, Black, and people of color communities in our region, because they are disproportionately impacted by development and gentrification that's happening in Kitchener-Waterloo. And having said that, it's about building relationships with communities, which can be a hurdle because, you know, it's not necessary that you'll have a connection to these communities, and that takes time.
Yeah, I think the question is what motivated the SDC to start this work. I definitely joined in even later than Fariel. But my understanding is that Brian, his own research was also looking at these sorts of changes, and he was working on, you know, understanding the changes of the LRT in downtown Kitchener and how developing for transit like that is actually affecting housing prices and the people who live there. So he was trying to understand how different communities are being displaced or moved. This project is actually following from a previous research study that he did last year, I guess 2019.
That was what was part of the oral history project.
Yeah, I think that's good to know that for people to know that this is, yeah, just one part of the work. And it does seem like such a great partnership between UW and the Social Development Center, both because sometimes, you know, community organizations can't access the research as easily as they would like. And then I know sometimes when people are doing research, that it's hard to reach people that you don't have relationships with prior. So, you know, the Social Development Center has long been known to have those relationships established over time. So I think that's great. What did that look like to put that all together? How did you reach out to people? Who were you trying to connect with?
We found participants through community members who are connected to spaces and individuals who experience displacement and have lived experience themselves. And we call them community connectors. And a lot of them were individuals who were members of working groups at SDC. So for example, at RENT, Renters Educating and Networking Together, or, you know, the Disabilities and Human Rights Group. It's just kind of word of mouth, really. And, you know, they're all very well informed of what's happening in their circles, in their neighborhood. So it was mainly through that. And during the interviews, we'd ask participants to think about specific places that they felt or have been displaced from, which is kind of how those spaces found themselves on the map.
So because of the pandemic, the interview process was actually, it was probably a little bit more complicated than it could have been otherwise, especially for the population that we were trying to especially talk to. So because we couldn't actually go out and because UW research ethics wouldn't allow us to do any in-person interviews, a lot of the people that we would want to talk to, like people who are unsheltered or in encampments, just they don't have email addresses, they don't have access to internet. So many of the people who I ended up speaking with, I got in contact through one of these community connectors who themselves was facing rent eviction. And they were really helpful in connecting us with people who they helped who were unsheltered or very precariously housed. For some people who didn't even have cell phones, they actually went out with a cell phone and allowed the participants to use their phones so we could have a conversation with them.
And yeah, like William's right, like sometimes you don't even have access to a phone. I had to interview somebody, and so I had them come to Social Development Center but sit in a different room. I gave them a phone, I sat in a completely different room, but I could hear the echo through the doors. But you know, you just have to make it work. I mean, there is obviously that fact that, you know, we might have lost access to some people because of, you know, the pandemic and so much else going on. People get really overwhelmed, so a lot of people didn't want to be interviewed at that point anymore because they're just going through too much.
Yeah, and another way that we found participants is like we would speak to someone and they'd give us their experiences and we'd ask them if they knew, like, what are some other people's experiences that you've heard? Surely you have stories about other people being displaced. And they would say, oh, you could interview this person, you know, they would be great. I can get you in touch with them. So a lot of it was also word of mouth. There's a whole community of people who have a shared experience and they're just not heard or seen in mainstream media or even discourse around development in the city.
You're talking a bit about people, yeah, facing displacement, being forced out of the space that their home that they're currently in. And the report mentions that the loss of affordable housing most often comes from demolition and renovations. And the report said that there's no real data that keeps track of that type of displacement. So I'm just wondering if you want to speak to that at all. I'm sure that was a big motivator for why you were involved in this project at all.
I know that at the region of Waterloo, they really look at the success of the redevelopment of downtown strictly from the perspective of the amount of dollars that have been invested into the area. So one of the figures that came up a lot was that because of the LRT, they have called $3 billion plus of investment into downtown and redeveloping the space, and that there are so many new residents and that the average income has increased by a lot. But that does not include any sort of information about who has moved out, you know, what affordable units have been lost. That's simply a lack of data that they have. You know, they have data that says that there's a lot of people moving in, but they don't have any data about what is being replaced. So for instance, on Scott Street, where we've got the boutique rental apartment, there were three houses that were all, you know, lodging houses, or they had several apartment units in them. And now it's, you know, a 14-story rental apartment boutique building. So in the city's data, it's going to say, oh, now there's a lot more units and there's a lot more rental. But the people who are living there, those rental apartments are not available for them. Mm-hmm. So it's an entire demographic that the data just doesn't show and can't capture.
Yeah, I was just going to say, municipalities don't track what's been lost. And so I was going to say that their focus is on what's new, what's coming up, and how that's going to happen, which is why, like, I think it was really important to do this map, because it tracks more than just physical changes that are occurring in the city. And that was one of my motivations to want to be able to work on this, because no one's looking at experiences or instances of displacement due to gentrification as a non-spatial displacement, which, you know, kind of helps us look at a completely different side of gentrification. And I think it's really important to map things like demolitions, renovations, evictions, to, you know, better understand how we can support the community and what's really happening. Why we decided to rely on mapping to share this. I was gonna say, like, just from a personal perspective, personal motivation, I mean, I love mapping and I wanted a visual storytelling component to the Oral History Project and the ongoing research with Dr. Brian Doucette. And it was a way for us to tie in geospatial elements to lived experience of spaces in connection to the city we live in. And from a research point of view, spatial knowledge is vital to understand changes that occur in our city and to understand the types of displacement that emerge, you know, through this mapping exercise. And there's many other cities that have done this. You know, for example, there's the anti-eviction mapping project in the Bay Area in New York. And then Toronto also has one from Keep Your Rent. And they started an anti-eviction mapping tool that tracks down evictions and rent hikes and LTV hearings in Toronto. The US also has one called Eviction Lab. So they track the number of evictions and the eviction rate in the US. I'd like to see more of that in Canada, though. I think there's one for Ottawa as well, but we don't have as much data in terms of that in Canada as in compared to the US. So I'd like to see more of that.
Mapping is just a really powerful way to talk about these sort of things. You know, we can say that there's like five instances where someone was displaced or was evicted in the city. And that might just kind of wash over someone. It's like, okay, there's a lot of displacement. Well, when you say there was five displacement here where you walk past and you see this every day, I think it just organizes it in a way that makes it like puts them in relation to each other in a way that makes more sense. Oh, these are all happening in this one little area. That is, you know, evidence of a broader systemic problem. Sometimes it's very difficult to even notice that renovation has happened and has displaced people. But like in some of these older apartment buildings or in some of the older houses, even a lot of them in downtown, especially single detached houses are split into several units. And you might not be able to see that from the outside, but, you know, if some new, you know, homeowner wants to come in and buy it and they all of a sudden want to renovate it into a single family unit, all of a sudden you're losing three affordable rental houses that are simply no longer available for renters. And that's impossible data to collect. I mean, it yeah. might be possible, but we just have no tools to collect that data right now, except from the people who are being pushed out. There's no way for this municipality to classify if that's lost or if it's just improved.
Yeah. Like, for example, even Midtown Lofts, right? It was, there was businesses at the bottom, but there were units at the top. And I think there must have been 12 to 15. But again, it's hard to find that information as well. I had to literally go through every single address to try to determine how many like approximate units there were, because I was counting mailboxes outside the doors, because I wondered how many people lost their homes in the process of building a condo that they aren't going to be able to afford. You lose a part of yourself, but you also lose, you feel like you're losing your space or your place in the city, because you know you're not part of it anymore, because they're like, well, we don't want you here, you can't afford it, so leave, which happens a lot. There's so many people that probably William and I interviewed who are thinking of leaving or know people who've left, you know, or don't even know what happened to them after they've been evicted. There's a lot of mysteries, but it's really unfortunate.
I do want to say that Google Street View is an incredible resource for this kind of stuff, because it has a time machine function where you can look at street view images from like up to 10 years ago, almost in some places. You can look at street view and you can dial back the time and see what was there 10 years ago, RT before the Midtown Lofts. You can see along Weaver Street back when it was just one lane across the train tracks there. You can see that there's a row of houses that just doesn't exist anymore. And we heard from some of our participants who lived in those houses before and they were neglected because they knew that the houses were going to be demolished.
Yeah, it was a feature that we used quite a lot to figure out what was there before, because a lot of times people would be talking about a specific place and then we knew it wasn't there anymore. But luckily, you know, because of the 10 years back, but it was anything 10 years before, I obviously you couldn't, but at least you could go back you know, between now and 10 years ago and figure out what was there before.
The main theme of this feels like this report is trying to bring to light some of that invisibility of these issues. And one of the things that you both have referenced, I think, was this idea of rent evictions, a term that was probably not known to many people, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, but I feel it's becoming more well known. But for those people who don't know what rent evictions is, I wonder if one of you are willing to just give a quick definition and what is problematic about rent evictions?
Very briefly, a rent eviction is basically when an apartment is affordable and then the owner renovates it. And by renovating it, they evict the tenant so that they can charge for a higher rent. And because of our tenant protections in Ontario, many people have been there for maybe 15 years. And that means that their rent is quite low compared to market rent now. And they're not allowed to evict them without any good reason. And one of the only reasons that you can evict someone with just cause is for renovations. So they'll say, we're renovating the unit, you have to leave. And then after it's renovated, because it's nicer, it's updated, they can rent it out for higher than market rate. So all of a sudden, this $800 apartment is now being rented out at $1,300, $1,400. As a single case, it's not probably not that bad. But when you have an entire apartment building that is being renovated one by one, where the entire building is being updated like that, it means that you're losing the entire building of affordable units.
Also, it happens where maybe it's not your current landlord, but they decide to sell the building to somebody else, and that property manager wants to renovate the building, which is how it and people end up being renovated. And I mean, recently I've been working on an out-of-core Kitchener project, so looking at real estate investment trusts and displacement in apartment buildings. And not that we've noticed a lot, too many rent evictions. There's been a few. We've also noticed, for example, property managers neglecting the space and letting it diminish, which leads to tenants feeling the need to move out. And then when the unit is vacant, that's when they decide to renovate it and then bump the prices. I'm not really sure if that's a rent eviction per se, but it is, in a way it is. It's just you're not handing a tenant a rent, an eviction notice. So, and in terms of rent eviction, if your apartment is being renovated, and as a tenant, you do have first right of refusal, you know, meaning you can return to your apartment at the same rent once it's ready, but that doesn't really necessarily work out or go the way it's supposed to. You know, the landlord has no obligation to let you know when it's ready. You know, you have to find a new place anyway to live while it's being renovated. And it could be over a year before you're able to move back in. You don't know. Well, you'll never know unless the landlord reaches out or you go and find out for yourself whether it's ready or not. For example, one of the participants I interviewed was worried that they wouldn't be able to move back in because she heard they were converting the units from a bachelor to a two-bedroom unit, and that would mean a change in rent.
So the report does mention a number of things that could be seen as successes around like the affordable housing strategy and using public lands to have like land leases to create more affordable housing. How do we make more of that happen? Is there something that we can do to create more of that?
I think one of the challenges that municipalities face in terms of tackling it is that there are so many different ways that we can do better in terms of providing affordable housing. So in terms of successes or things that are being done correctly right now, the Region of Waterloo, they're working on an affordable housing strategy where they want to build 2,500 affordable units in the next 5 years, which is 5 years faster than their previous goals for building that many units. And they also want to leverage public lands for affordable housing, and they want to, you know, have a community engagement plan, which are all things that we asked for in our report. You know, we should temper our expectations with those because they're also just not nearly enough. You know, 2,500 units doesn't even do half of the 6,000 wait list. They haven't even addressed collecting data for rent evictions and displacement like we're trying to address in this report.
It's not enough to meet the needs of the population that's struggling with housing. It's just not enough. And construction takes time. You know, it's not going to be built by tomorrow, which is when we need housing. So
is there a plan for sort of next steps? Like, is this being presented to councils or elected officials, or is it just a community resource? What's sort of the next steps for things?
It just came out. And so I think right now it's for everyone to see, like to understand what it's about and for people to you know, read the report, educate themselves, raise awareness. And I hope that it'll make it to council at some point. We haven't really had that conversation yet, but we're hoping that it can be a tool for the city to use and to understand what their residents are going through. You know, it's really important to be able to care for your community. And if you don't know what's happening, then how are you supposed to do that?
I think this is a really good tool to legitimize a lot of the concerns that a lot of housing advocates have been pressing for so long. Like, unaffordability is not new. Like, we've known about this problem for a very long time, and advocates have been saying it, but having a report, you know, that has, you know, spoken word testimony from people saying how it affects them is really good ammunition to say, look, you know, we're not just making this up. People need housing. This is, you know, this is terrible conditions that people should not have to live through. We need to do something now. We can't just say 2,500 is enough. So I think just in terms of, you know, informing further advocacy and also legitimizing it.
The challenge with the housing crisis is that it can feel like this huge problem, and that people struggle to see what they can, if there's any action they can take on an individual level. Are there things that individuals can do to participate in this work?
I think it needs to be an individual and collective effort. Make sure you know who you're voting for and someone who wants to put housing first. You know, someone who wants there to be guaranteed income, especially for our lower income population, like, and use funds not to keep people on the street, but reallocate it towards housing. And, you know, something that came up in the research often was a lack of knowledge and support for tenants. And if tenants don't know their rights and don't have the support to challenge our current systems, it's difficult to do anything about it. Like, during this pandemic, hearings are happening online, and then tenants aren't getting enough notice to be able to prepare themselves. So one part has been mentioned that if you're getting your notice in the mail and your hearing is online, it doesn't leave much time for you to prepare. Sometimes you're not even getting your notice until after the online hearing. And so if you're getting that in the mail, then you've missed your hearing and you've missed your opportunity to speak for yourself. And, you know, residents give up. They give up. There's been many participants I interviewed who were so fed up about what's happening in their buildings. The best choice for them was to move. That's the only option they have left. And, you know, they're slowly driven out of their homes. It's a traumatic experience, and no one should have to go through that.
I think probably the best thing is to get informed and, like, educate yourselves about how the systems that we all participate in perpetuate the housing crisis and the current situation that really disaffects, disenfranchises, and displaces so many people in our communities. You know, our current system where we buy and sell houses kind of anonymously, and we hope for the highest bidder. Like, those are contributing to high house prices when we want and seek the highest bid price and the sale price. You know, something that I often think, we would have cheaper houses if people just refused to sell their houses for too expensive, right? But that, you know, those are difficult things for us to solve on our own. Those are something that we all kind of have to have trust that collectively we're all doing the same thing. But being able to recognize where those things are that are contributing to that and how we contribute to those, I think, is really important, so that we can call out our government, call out our leaders and say, like, this is something that we want to change, not just me individually, but everyone.
I'd love to see people rally for housing. We have a housing crisis, not just in Kitchener-Waterloo, but across the country. You know, it's not a one city problem. It's an entire country problem. So it's something that we need to address now.
The report does outline several recommendations for next steps. Those five recommendations are to incorporate the perspectives, voices, and lived experiences of poverty into planning and policy decision-making, better enforcement of property standards and regulations designed to protect tenants, increase efforts to preserve existing affordable housing through municipal enforcement, bylaw and fire prevention and rent controls, and ensure tenants' rights are protected if a property is renovated. Use publicly owned land to build new, non-market affordable housing in conjunction with local nonprofits. And lastly, ensure municipalities provide adequate, safe, secure, and welcoming public spaces, particularly in downtown areas. The report also calls for the provincial government to reintroduce rent controls, including end-of-tenancy rent controls. Those are the rules that would say landlords could not simply raise the rent to whatever they like when a tenant moves out of a place. Lastly, the report says that higher levels of government also need to directly fund the construction of new non-market affordable housing that is targeted to low-income and no-income populations. In regards to next steps, staff at the Social Development Center said that they are working on their plan, but they hope to reflect on how their data and stories align with municipal strategies in order to have conversations with municipal staff and local councils about the report's recommendations. They are also connecting with other local organizations to continue this work together where appropriate. Thanks to both Faryal Dewan and William Terman for their time. You can find out more about the Mapping Displacement Project and this recent report by visiting the Social Development Center's website at waterlooregion.org. If you're interested in hearing some of the stories of displacement, Radio Waterloo has been airing the podcast produced by Brian Doucette and the Social Development Center of Waterloo Region. These life stories of displacement were used in the research that led to this report. You can find these on the Social Development Center's website. And at the time of this airing, the episodes of Life Stories of Displacement currently airs on Mondays at 1 p.m. on CKMS Radio Waterloo. I'm Melissa Bowman for CKMS News on 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. Thanks for tuning in. That concludes this episode, which focused on the Social Development Center's Mapping Displacement Project. This program is part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can find out more about this initiative, as well as all of the CKMS programming at Radio Waterloo. Also, feel free to continue this conversation. You can find me on Twitter at M2Bowman. Thanks for listening.